Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with founder and director of 3AM Communications and the professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Professor Bernard Glassman. We'll be talking about how emerging technologies can be used to promote health. And I know Adam and I are really excited to welcome him today.
Yeah, and we'd also like to let our listeners know that we're going to do the show a little bit differently today. We've invited Professor Glassman here to join us really for the whole show. And I don't think we've ever done a show like that, Christy. So I'm pretty excited by that.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
And
see how it goes.
And we're going to talk about research that matters. We'll hear your listener calls and comments. And we'll hear from Professor Glassman about his areas of interest and work. So welcome to our show, Professor Glassman.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, let's just dive right in here, because this issue of public health and emerging technologies, and we have research really that has to do with it, and our very first research about public health and technology. What is it, Christy?
The first one is about Google using their technologies, chat rooms, news reports, and blogs to track disease across the globe.
Yeah, I heard about this last year when, you know, for people type in influenza on Google, and apparently it's quicker at identifying trends about what's happening influenza around the country, maybe around the world, than the Centers for Disease Control. I found that amazing.
Yeah, 2 weeks for the CDC and pretty instant for Google to be able to track this. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that we have to be very cautious about what we learn from Google or from any online tracking system. I think that while Google will be the first to tell you that they get the information first, we also have to understand that the quality of the information that they may get may not be as reliable as what CDC gets, because CDC gets it from reporting points where people are trained how to report this stuff.
I wondered, too, a lot of people might think they have the flu, but there's so many flu-like illnesses. So I wondered if the Google way might overestimate how much true influenza is happening versus what the CDC is tracking.
And it's hard to know whether it overestimates or underestimates, because you can think of reasons why Google might not pick things up just as easily as why it might pick up false positives.
Well, the study talked about 90% accuracy compared with the Center for Disease Control. So that sounds
pretty good. And I guess there's questions about when would this sort of technology really help us? You know, is it that important that we know within 2 days versus 2 hours about something occurring? And I can imagine there are times and instances like a recent tsunami when time is of the essence, but many other things maybe not.
Well, if you own stock in a flu vaccine, for example, or in something that's being sold over the counter, the sooner you can detect an increase, the sooner you can buy that stock before anybody else does.
Yeah, so from a business perspective, it raises some really important ethical issues.
It does raise those issues, and it also suggests the possibility of gaming the system and making those things appear to be there when they're not.
Well, we want to get your take on the next research that matters, which is about UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, using cell phone technology for reporting and for help in the developing world.
Yeah, this was being done in Malawi, where we know that malnutrition and disease among children is very, very high. And they were using technology vis-a-vis the cell phone and text messaging for workers in the field to really track children's weight and height and body mass index and immediately have this data transmitted centrally so that they could feed this information back rather than months, potentially within days or even less, back to the field to really understand at-risk infants, at-risk families, and hopefully intervene. I don't know. What did you think, Christy?
Well, looking at this, it sounds like it usually took 2 to 3 months to, like, paper sent, mail the data off, and then get the data back, a very cumbersome mail system, and that by using the cell phone technology, they could get the information much, much faster to allow the group to use their resources in the children that really needed it, or to be able to focus their resources potentially within a region that's having more trouble with nutrition. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, and it sounds like it's better than the alternative.
You know, Professor Gossam, you've had a lot of experience in the business world. To what extent do you see the business world really embracing technology like this? Because I could see it. Certainly, this could reduce cost of running a study substantially.
It could reduce cost to next to zero, actually. What's interesting is that countries differ so dramatically in the way you pay for text messaging, for example, so that in Malawi, I'm actually not sure. I'm pretty sure that's that you pay per unit.
In this case, the cell phone company gave them reduced rates or donated that ability.
That's right. In India, it's free. Text messaging is free in India. And so if I were going to launch one of these and perfect it, I would probably do it in India where texting is at no cost. And the need is every bit as great in many areas of India as it is in Malawi. That's not to say don't do it in Malawi. But finding the money to do this and getting the cell companies to say, yes, I'll give you this time. Or these, you know, these units. That's a challenge, and it's a big challenge for public health people who aren't accustomed to negotiating for airtime.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, your own background. Tell us a little bit about your background, because it's clear that you have this business background. I think, as Christy mentioned, you've founded, led, currently lead businesses that are involved in health and health technology. But you also have now this appointment in the School of Public Health, and you're working in academia. Tell us, how did you get interested in this merging of these two fields?
Well, this is a story that I actually don't tell very often, but when my mother was in the hospital with cancer, she was denied access to the hospital library by her physician. She didn't understand why she kept getting sick when they were giving her chemotherapy. And she was convinced that they were giving her the wrong amount. And she just, all she wanted to do was find the journal articles that said how much she should be getting. They wouldn't let her. This was years ago. I mean, I was 25 years old. I'm 66 now, so you can imagine. But she knew she was getting the wrong thing. And she died never realizing, and we only found out afterwards, that she'd been getting 10 times the dose that she was supposed to be getting.
So she had this innate understanding,
yes.
But yet information flow was being restricted.
So had she been able to get at information, you know, she was a mere patient, so she wasn't permitted to see it. But had she been able to get at that information, she would have been able to call their attention to the fact that they were overdosing her with chemotherapy. So when you learn a thing like that, you say, how can I keep this from happening to people? So I have been deeply involved in trying to get health information to the patient in the most timely fashion possible ever since I discovered that fact. And that's really been my passion. That's why 3 a.m. communication is called 3 a.m. communication. It's so that at 3 o'clock in the morning,
if you want that information,
when you wake up
and you're anxious because you're
worried about that text, that
yep.
The lab test.
So you talk about this your business, 3 a.m. communications. What exactly is it?
Well, right now what it is giving advice to healthcare providers. UNC Hospital, for example, has been a client of mine on how to do a better job of communicating with patients using the newest technologies, Twitter, Facebook, Foursquare.
Well, like I'm a little concerned here that you might be evaluating Christy and I.
I know.
I will probably be doing that.
Well, that does bring us to, we wanted
our first
to take
listener
a, yeah,
call.
Take
yeah,
a question from our listener. What do we have first today?
In what ways do you see the use of technology in your everyday practice as being a benefit or barrier to your ability to do your job?
It's a huge question that, I mean, I can list off a few things. I use it every day for looking up medications, for looking up the most up-to-date research, and just for documenting what's happening with patients and seeing what happened to them when they went to the emergency room or somewhere else.
Yeah, I do the same things, Christy, and I think that our conversation with Professor Glassman kind of highlights this tension, though. While all of that is really good, it's also very easy to be in the exam room and be sitting down looking at your computer while you're telling the patient something that may be incredibly anxiety-producing, like a test result. And it's also this kind of like, I have the information behind my screen, do you not have that same information? And I wonder, Professor Glassman, how does that play out just in your experience?
Well, what plays out in my experience is the fact that there tends to be a great deal of consistency. The physician who sits at the bedside burying his nose or her nose in the chart is going to be the same person who sits behind the screen and or is spending all their time looking down at their keyboard and at their screen and not communicating with directly with the patient. A physician who is committed to patient communication, it's not going to matter that much whether they've got paper or whether they've got a screen, except for one thing, and that's comprehensive, you know, whether it's comprehensive information and how fast it can be. Mm-hmm. So you can give me my latest results quickly and still hold my hand while you're doing it, if that's who you are as a physician. If you're not, you can hide behind anything.
Sure. Well, this is only the beginning of that conversation, but we do need to take a break from our first segment. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with founder and director of 3AM Communications and professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Professor Bernard Glassman. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been having a really fascinating conversation today about technology and public health. We're really fortunate to be joined by Mr. Bernard Glassman, entrepreneur, businessman, and professor as well at UNC. And right before we broke, Mr. Glassman, we were talking about this idea of patients and doctors in the clinical examination room and this use of technology and how it works. And we have another example from a listener, and I wonder if we can just take a listen to their question, and then we'll get some comments.
I took a picture of my partner's wound on his leg and sent it to his doctor and asked what we should do, and he prescribed an antibiotic and thanked me. And I'm wondering if this is going to become a process for the future and have doctors figured out how they might bill.
I don't know what your take on this, Adam, was, but I mean, I read this and thought, well, isn't that awesome? It's great. It's fast. It's quick. In this case, it sounds like it was a positive thing that happened in terms of the wound. Hopefully got better, or you'd be telling us about that. But there are some issues figuring out how to get accurate information, how to get the right information, and how to bill for it, as you bring up. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I actually have some problems with it, Christy, because I think it's good to use it as an adjunct tool, but the moment you start relying on this for a diagnosis without being able to talk with someone, and particularly here, it's not even the patient, it's the patient's relative, friend, son, whatever, and billing, I think that's an issue because we have a livelihood, but I think this is fraught with all kinds of problems, particularly related to in our litigious society around misdiagnoses as well. I don't know. I'm conflicted.
I wonder, could it be done well? And what do you think, Professor Glassman?
Well, obviously, we have higher and lower resolution cameras now that we can be taking our pictures with and sending them off with, and I think that it ought to be possible to make judgments on a case-by-case, no pun intended, basis because frankly, if I use one of my very high resolution cameras that gets really good color and if I'm a good photographer and I get good light on it, why shouldn't you have that? It might be every bit as good as if I were sitting in your room in your office.
Well, I do think there's this belief that we can have the conversation, but I think where I would like to see that technology is to supplement the conversation. So maybe if I needed to consult a dermatologist, I can send that picture out and the dermatologist and have a conversation. This is what I saw. This is what I thought. And then maybe hear what else. But to replace that provider content and without an interaction, to me, I get worried by that.
Well, and there should be technologies developing, you would know, that would allow more interaction between the physician and the patient electronically with perhaps the picture or not.
Absolutely. But what's happening, and this is, I actually talked to somebody who was building a business doing this. You would send off a picture plus your medical question. It would be immediately rerouted to India. Nothing against Indian medicine. Seriously, there's some wonderful physicians over there. But then at a very low cost, somebody over there was doing the diagnosis. It was then coming back and being sold. The result was
like
being sold
like a chest
to the patient.
X-ray,
very much the way you might send a chest X-ray off for review. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a little scarier to me because you don't know if they don't have any investment in the person and no investment of getting sued or whatever, then they're just sort of making a quick judgment. But it's probably not going to be right without any more information because they don't get a history.
You have no way of knowing whether it's right or wrong.
Right.
Well, I know that one of your areas of interest, Professor Glassman, is bringing this technology or to see and evaluate how this technology is increasingly used in public health. And you teach in the school. How do the next generation of learners, how are they learning about this? And is it influencing, you know, what they learn both for good and maybe not for good? I don't know if it's all good.
You remember years ago, there was the phrase, the digital divide. Remember, everybody was talking about the digital divide. You still see an enormous digital divide, both among physicians and all kinds of health caregivers and among patients. And so among older physicians, for example, there's still this tremendous fear of almost anything that has to do with the internet. Or I used to go to medical meetings where I was speaking, and you could see physicians talking to one another in the hallway, and they would be holding their hands. I obviously, over the radio, this is hard to do, but they would be holding something that was very thick between their hands, imaginary. Right? Just holding them out. And you would know that in each and every case, the conversation was as follows. My patients are coming in to see me, and they've got to print out this thick of stuff that they've found on the internet about their what they think their disease is. And I've got to know everything that's in that stack of stuff.
Tremendous frustration.
Tremendous frustration. It's still there. And for every one of those now, however, there's a physician who's saying, oh, we got to have an app. We've got to make an app for our practice.
Right. Wide extremes.
Yeah. What about in the realm of teaching a generation of public health practitioners? Is there an embracement of this technology?
There is a tremendous embracement. And yet, when we put on our class of on emerging technologies in public health, you'd be surprised at the number of people who enrolled who had never used Twitter, never used Facebook, and they were doing it for the first time. They loved it. In fact, it was kind of hard to get them away from the screen, to get them to be, you know, to listen
focus.
To the lecture.
What does it take the place of core competencies? It's almost like in medicine,
right.
You know, you may be great at Facebook and taking pictures of patients, but can you really still diagnose and come up with a differential diagnosis?
It's a very, very good question. I think that, however, what we're seeing is examples of some extraordinarily astute use of social media by the medical community. And that's only going to get better over time. It's not going to get...
Thinking of those people who say, is there an app for that? The next research that we have is about an app for mobile phones that can transition them into microscopes to be used in developing countries or even in this country, I guess. Let's talk about that research.
Yeah, I found this really interesting, Christy, because it's to say that you can develop a $20, $30 application to attach and look under your cell phone, which I can't, the resolution's great,
sure.
And to see what you would normally see under a microscope intuitively sounds amazing, like maybe you could diagnose malaria in the field in developing countries. I don't know if this is the way people are thinking about it. I don't think this is being thought of as a way to increase science interest among our young, but maybe this is something that the Gates Foundation wants to do to increase our ability to cure diseases internationally. Have you come across this, Professor?
Well, there's of course, this whole field called telemedicine, where what you do is you rely on less skilled, less trained people in the field to gather information, whether it's a microscopic photograph. This is going to be amazing if people can be taught to actually use this thing and then transmit it back to an expert such as yourselves.
Or someone in a lab. White blood cell count or look for a parasite. I mean, some of that.
Sure. Sure.
A lot of the doctors in the field could do as well.
That's right. And today a camera, you know, a microscopic camera, tomorrow hematocrit. I mean, where does it stop? There's really...
Right. You should be able to diagnose anemia, diabetes, some common diseases.
That's right.
Reliably with community health workers using these fairly low-cost...
That's right.
...cellular phone applications.
That's
very
right.
Exciting.
Very exciting.
I mean, we worry about access to care. And that, I mean, something like this really could revolutionize.
It could.
People's access. Okay. Well, and then we've got another thing to talk
Well,
about.
No, the last piece of information, I think, in this particular segment was a listener actually calling in, though, being frustrated by some of the overwhelming amount of information out there. Let's hear this next listener call.
When I have a question about my health, I often type it into Google, but so many results pop up. How do I know which to trust?
This is a great question, and one we have to actually incorporate into our teaching of young physicians in medical school and also in residency, of how, because they're using Google too, and how so the physicians know what to trust and what not to trust. But we have a few tips.
Well, first off, if it comes from Christy and I, no.
It's probably great.
You know it. No. I don't want to go there.
Or maybe
but
not.
I do think you have to ask who's the sponsor
yes.
of this information. And if it's a commercial sponsor, which isn't always obvious, then I have some concerns about it. And one of the tips that I didn't know till recently was this difference between .org and .com, .gov and .edu. Those, you know, if it comes from the government or edu education, .org, a community-based frequently organization, or .com, a for-profit. I don't know. Does that make a difference?
No.
You don't think so? Why
no.
not?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons. For one thing, I'm not saying that therefore don't do it, but I am suggesting that you never can drop your guard when it
okay.
comes to looking at this stuff. I don't care whether it's .com. You know, with your last name
associated
with it.
If it comes from the government,
even if it's
the NIH.
Dot Goldstein, still better look at it.
My family wouldn't like that one either.
And there are reasons for that. One is that almost anybody can get something onto a .gov, can get something out there so that it ends with a .gov if, for example, they've filed a report with the Department of Agriculture in which they've held some kind of really bizarre opinion. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be found with a search on that comes out under .gov. .org, anybody can have a .org. I have a .org.
So you have to have a tremendous skepticism.
Oh, totally.
What's the advice for our listener?
The single best advice that I would give is to find a long-standing patient group that has been communicating back and forth, like a listserv or a chat room or anything that consists of patients that have been on for a long time on Yahoo, on Google Groups, or one of these places. Don't just take the first thing that you find with a Google search.
Well, and
find
even those chat rooms sometimes they have misinformation.
And then you've got to stay in there for a while. Don't take the very first thing you find there. But
right.
typically, there are smart people who clean those things up.
And I'd say, if in doubt, ask your physician as well about the specific topic.
And my final tip is, if it seems too good to be true, it is.
It probably is. That's really good. We're going to need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a bit to talk with our guest, founder and director of 3AM Communications and professor at UNC, Bernard Glassman, about emerging technologies in public health. We'll be right back with Your Health. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Professor Bernard Glassman about emerging technologies in public health, and we are excited to be back and continue that conversation.
You know, Professor Glassman, right before we broke, we were talking about a listener who is really overwhelmed by Google, and we've talked actually a little bit about Google in the first segment, and it appears to me that this idea of this collection of information about patients that continues to grow and be out there for others raises all kinds of issues. We're all moving to electronic medical records. That also collects information and stores it in locations where it could also be violated. You've had a lot of experience with electronic medical records. Tell us a little bit about how you view this really explosion. I mean, it's now reached, I think, a tipping point.
You know, I'm going to tell you, I have to do an anecdote first.
Absolutely.
So I just had my quinquennial physical. It should have been an annual physical, but it had been 5 years. And in case there was any question about what quinquennial means.
And I'm like thinking, so, scratching my head.
Yeah, quinquennial. So I had my quinquennial physical, and in the process of that, we discussed possibility of some arthritis. I'm 66. We discussed a couple of other little things that were going on. Within 5 days of that physical, I was invited to join a clinical trial for arthritis. I had never received any mailing relating to arthritis until I'd had that physical. And I was invited to join to get medication for diabetes because there was some question about the fact that my blood sugar, I say because, that's wrong. It also happened at my physical that they found slightly elevated blood sugar. Was it a coincidence that never prior to that physical had I received anything medical.
Ding, 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 ding. These were not from your doctor.
These were not from my doctor. These were from independent, supposedly independent organizations. And by the way, I don't think anything was entered into an electronic medical record at that particular point.
Oh, I wish if you guys out there could see the look on my face. That is really shocking.
It's not a good look.
No, not attractive.
So what did you think?
Well, I thought, I immediately called the place where I had had this physical, yep. and I said, are you selling my data to anybody? I mean, it's a fair question
right,
to
sure.
ask.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we would never do such a thing. They might not, but the fact that they might have somebody working there who's making $4.95 an hour, who's able to pick up an extra couple of bucks by making these things and getting taking out.
But isn't that illegal?
Well, it's utterly. I mean, doesn't HIPAA, won't the HIPAA police come and break in and arrest anybody for doing that? Of course they will. Right.
So that's a great example of the threat of electronic medical records.
Just make that easier is what I'm saying. Could make that kind of dissemination of the facts about you easier. The problem is, of course, that there's already so much out there. If I wanted to find out what was bothering you, all I'd have to do is go through your Twitter feed and discover that you'd had a headache yesterday morning, or your Facebook page and discover that you had, you know, were fighting constipation.
Well, and if an electronic health record like we have at UNC, if that is, you know, policed properly and follows the proper channels, as they go to great lengths to make sure it does, shouldn't that not happen? I mean, isn't it better for our health in other ways?
Those things are so easy to hack. I can tell you right now, I mean, that shouldn't keep you from doing it. But I'm going to say, don't pretend that you have that kind of privacy. It's just, it would be a myth. When I was at this doctor's office, somebody comes in and they go to the console that's sitting there in the examining room. They type in their password. I saw them type their password. Right. Then they leave to go do whatever it is that people do when they leave you alone in the examining room. They had logged out, but I knew how to get in. I saw their password. Now, you know, once I've done that, the world is at my feet. Right. So if I could do it, so could somebody who's not a good guy.
And these systems do have. Do you want us to keep your password? These super systems actually is interesting. We have a research article here. I'd like to hear Christy and your viewpoints on it. You know, these super systems that collect information. We saw there was an article, research article, about this computer at Jeopardy in Watson that kind of beat all these Jeopardy contestants. But the question is, what about using these type of supercomputers that store massive amounts of information, and would they be good for healthcare?
Could they go on there to answer a health question and give somebody the correct answer? And can that replace a doctor, or when do we actually need to have critical reasoning skills? I mean, I'm sure some things could be done by a computer-generated intelligence. What do you think?
You know, one of the very first uses of artificial intelligence when they started experimenting with it was medical. I mean, the folks at Stanford started immediately trying to create a doctor on a hard drive to see if they could do it. And they failed, they're the first to admit, they failed and they failed and they failed. But there are new kinds of computing now that allow us to average over a large number of presentations and a large number of diagnoses, and you begin to see the trends and the threads. And if presented with this, 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 and this, what do the vast majority of physicians come back with? That begins to approximate playing chess with a computer or these other things.
Well, we have a question from a listener that kind of gets at a little bit of this, and I will be curious again what you all think. Let's take a listen to this house call question that came in about why this person did or didn't get the flu this year.
So my question is, I got the flu shot and I still got the flu. Why is that?
Well, and could Watson answer that? Could a computer answer that question? I don't know.
Well, there's certain statistical elements, which is, you know, if you get the flu shot before flu season, you have a 2/3 reduction of getting the flu. If you get it after flu season, it doesn't help you. That if you get the flu shot when you're over age 65, it reduces deaths by 50%. But we also know the individual effectiveness for you is only 40% to 50%. So I guess those are facts.
Right, facts that could be used. But
would
also,
that answer the question?
I mean, and there's variation from year to year on how well the flu shot protects us from each strain of flu that you can't predict.
So let me ask you a question. I'm in your office, and I ask you that question. How do you answer it? You're not going to run blood tests on me and say, oh, here's why. You're not going to genotype me and say, oh, here's why. You're going to go to the very same mental storehouse of literature that we're going to call it Watson for now, would have gone to, and you're going to sort through it. Now you'll see me, right? And you'll know something about me. You'll know my age. You'll know some of my, you can make some guesses about whether I'm, well, you'll know whether I'm a smoker because you can smell it. You know, Watson can't.
And for our listeners, we can tell you're not.
Anymore.
I don't smell it.
But the question here would be that the interaction, it's not just the information here that transmit. It's the understanding of, does that answer and testing your understanding of this? And then how likely is this information going to influence your future decision up to getting a flu shot in the future, and then keep your trust with the system? And could the computer do both of those? And
not just answer the question, but also tailor it to you and follow up.
What if I don't know I'm talking to a computer?
The other thing.
You don't think Christy and I are computers, do you?
No, but what I'm saying,
yes.
You and I have an email exchange about me and my flu and why did I get it. Okay.
Uh-huh. Interesting research question. Fascinating.
Watson and I have an email exchange.
Yeah. No. I think this is important. I mean, we're gonna need to take a short break, but we're going to pick up on this question here and even the really coming back around, I think, in our last segment to how What are the things that we're doing now that actually really can transform the practice of public health? We're talking with Professor Bernard Glassman. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page and our fantastic guest today, Professor Bernard Glassman. We're talking today about emerging technologies in public health, and we were just having a fascinating conversation about the use of computer systems replacing a physician, perhaps, or answering questions and providing health care without the need of a human being.
And I guess one question I have, Professor Glassman, you've actually just been to a physician recently. Would the experience be the same for you if you just interacted with a computer? What's the value added in today's medical emerging marketplace of the provider, of the public health practitioner? Is it more than just information?
This particular physician interaction that I had would have been a complete failure. In fact, I would have walked out of the if I'd been talking to a computer, because much of what, in this case, she was able to pick up was based on things that had nothing to do with just question and answer kinds of things. She could see, hear how I felt about certain things. She saw me raise my eyebrows when she gave me a particular piece of information. Computer, as yet, isn't picking up those kinds of things. And so she was able to say, I see you have some doubts about that. Well, it's going to be a while before we have an interface that'll
do
that.
To hear the tone of your voice,
yeah,
the expression,
yeah.
See the expression.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a tremendous added value in a one-on-one, person-to-person kind of thing. On the other hand, I have had physician interactions where I would have much preferred to be talking to a computer.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Well, you know it was coming.
It makes Christy and I cringe.
Somebody comes blowing through and can't raise their head from the chart.
Right.
That's talking about, and they're gone.
And I see an abnormal chest X-ray, and oops, wrong person.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's that easy. But the other
Your name
question,
is Mary, isn't it? Well, oh, wait, no.
The question about the flu that we answered before the break, that's something you could Google, flu and effectiveness, or know how to Google it, and you could come up with the CDC response to
a
similar question.
That's right. I don't need you for that.
Maybe if millions of people are asking the same question, a physician's answered it once online, well, maybe a computer can find that for me.
That's right.
Well, you know, one of the things, and we have a research article we want to talk about next, that we have these epidemics, as are routinely talked about in today's terms, of obesity and lack of exercise, the chronic disease of the 21st century affecting groups across the world, and certainly here in the U.S. And we want to talk about this because we know you have a really particular interest in it. But this particular article had to do with the use of the WII, not you and I, but the WII, by Nintendo and how it's actually being used to promote physical activity.
Well, and I love this because we use Wii Fit some at home, and I just got this Michael Jackson dance game to get the kids moving, you know, during the colder nights, and it's pretty ridiculous as long as we're not on video. But the question is using the Wii balance board, the Wii Fit with yoga and strength training and aerobics, is that better than regular aerobic exercise? Is it better than teenagers who may just be sitting watching TV or playing computer games?
And they looked at the use of this Wii versus traditional exercise and looked at energy expenditure and heart rate across a wide variety of these Wii Fit games. And they actually did show that their activity levels were higher using these activities, but it was less than the more aerobic activities.
Like on a treadmill.
Yeah, like on a treadmill. On the other hand, it seemed like that they were more enjoyable.
Yeah, they measured group enjoyment.
than the treadmill. So you had this incredible technology that may be promoting fitness and exercise. What do you think? Is this the future?
For one thing, I would look very hard at this research for several reasons. One is that they were putting plastic masks on everybody, you know, the rubber masks on everybody while they were doing this stuff. And quite honestly, it is a whole lot easier to run on a treadmill for a long period of time wearing a mask than it is to stand on a balance board doing all of those things.
And
anybody who pretends that you can wear one of those masks and do yoga, breathe, you know, and you're, with this rubber thing on your face is nuts. The other thing you might want to
notice.
It's
kind of like being on the airplane and the steward says, please take out that card and take down that mask.
Right. Yeah, when the mask falls, just breathe normally as the plane plummets.
Yes.
Exactly.
You know,
breathe normally.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to also mention is that this particular article was research that was actually funded by Nintendo. You don't see that when you only read the abstract, which is what most people only get. I mean, nobody reads all the way to the very end of the article. And now, does that make it suspect? I mean, it does make it wrong.
It's suspect.
But suspect.
Sure.
Worth knowing, right?
Yeah, no, I had a patient recently who came in to see me who actually had an injury of his quadriceps. And actually, as I was talking with it, he said he had gotten one of these Wii Fit and had started doing bowling. But someone who was very
exercise.
Physically inactive in
sure,
their late
not?
70s and now doing the bowling Wii.
Sure.
And, you know, it's very
it's
interesting.
More than sitting on the couch, for sure.
Right. I thought that was a good thing in general, other than the injury.
The other thing I wanted to say about this publication is this brings to light something else, and that is it came out after something called the Kinect. Are you familiar with the Kinect for the Xbox from
No.
Microsoft? That's something that you don't need any equipment for. You just stand in front of what amounts to a camera and move.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, you had this really strong interest, clearly, in fitness. You told us a little bit right
true.
When you first got here that you're working in this area and obviously trying to use the business marketing community to help develop some innovations here, and you're in public health now. What are you working on?
Well, what I'm working on right now, and I'm only going to give you the top line of this, is I'm working on the premise that kids can learn to can walk and learn at the same time. So we're trying to combine exercise and school learning. And hopefully I'll be on here in another 6 months after we have some research results, because this is going to be evidence-based.
Instead of this cutting physical education in schools and all this because they have so much to learn, and yet we have a very important public health problem with obesity, you're
That's
trying
right.
to figure out, can they exercise and learn at the same time?
Can what they keep preparing
question?
For those tests while they get their exercise?
Well, That's we already exciting. Know that they can text, call, be on the searching, watch TV.
And cross the street in front of my car without looking up all at the same time.
They can multitask.
But could they do these things well? I guess that's, you know.
Well, I don't know. They don't cross the street all
I've
that well.
I've seen some, we reviewed some information that says in the PET scans of the brain.
Right. That was good.
That kids can only do two things at one time. If in this moment you get more, you know, really more than two, the brain starts having some dysfunctional things. You know, great, interesting questions that you're asking.
Yeah, and I don't have any answers, but we will, and I'll be happy to report them when we do.
We are looking forward to that.
So one last thing, if you were making some recommendations for our listeners out there, what are one or two kind of take-home points? We've had an incredible conversation today, really focusing from the clinical all the way up to the public health. What are one or two take-home messages you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think that people should learn how to be very, very cautious consumers of online information relating to their health, and before they take any action that has potential consequences, they should still feel like they can call a doctor and ask the doctor that question.
So access to the personal physician.
I'm endorsing it, and I'm getting no reimbursement from either of you two for having said that.
And you can call Christy and I at any time.
Well, Professor Glassman, thank you for being with us today and for continuing a conversation back and forth between our research and house calls. It's really been fun.
Yeah, we've enjoyed it.
It's been my pleasure.
This has been something that maybe Christy and I will do this a little bit more often. We appreciate you taking your time and your expertise, and we thank all of you for being with us today for your help.
And we hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to write us, give us feedback about our show today, share your questions. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
Go online at yourhealthradio.org or Twitter, our own social media, and search for Your Health Radio.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Professor Bernard Glassman. Thank you.
And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.